Welcome to Florida.
That is New York Times bestselling author Craig Pittman. He is also an environmental reporter. My name is Chad Scott, and he was wearing the environmental reporter hat. Last week, there was big news out of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. They were ruling on a proposal to ban the ownership, import, export of invasive reptiles. A big issue considering what Burmese pythons are doing to this state. Fill in the audience, Craig, on what they were talking about, what the feedback was from the public, and what they ruled on.
Well, it was hugely controversial. The Wildlife Commission was considering a proposal to ban possession of 16 different kinds of non-native reptiles, different sorts of pythons, Burmese, reticulated, etc.
This is just possession, so you can't have them, let alone breed them or sell them or import them. But you can't have them.
Right. Iguana, green iguanas were another one. Argentine tegus, which are sort of this new wave of invasives that are starting to spread. And the goal here, you know, in some, you might look at it and go, well, gee, this is kind of slamming the barn door after the horse is long gone. Right. Yeah. But their attitude on this, on the pythons in particular, was we've got this established population in South Florida that is growing and we're having a really hard time keeping up with it. We don't want a new population popping up somewhere else in the state because people let them go. Mm-hmm. So the idea is let's try and squash that before it starts to spread. The pythons and the iguanas are particularly bad. And but what made it controversial was that, you know, the reptile industry is not on board with this at all. And people who are hobbyists, who love snakes, who own snakes, people who actually regard them, several of them said, I regard my snakes as my children. Mm-hmm. The one woman who talked about having an emotional support iguana, believe it or not, and actually kind of got kind of teary-eyed talking about it, that this is something that is very near and dear to them, and they were freaking out about it. And the commission was saying, you know, look, any pets you own now, you can continue to own. You just can't buy any new ones, and you can't let these that you have breed. But now the industry folks, they were the ones who were really kind of in a world of hurt. And some of the things they said, it would not surprise me if there's a lawsuit over this. In fact, one of the people who testified was an economist who said he'd been hired by the Holland and Knight law firm, which was working for a big organization of reptile dealers. So that's kind of a red flag right there of, hey, we're going to haul you into court.
Right. Well, and the Fish and Wildlife Commission voted 7-0, unanimous to ban possession, a lot to sort through here. I am very sympathetic to those pet owners who love their snake, love their iguana. I will make the analogy to this. There's a lot of people who like to have a couple of beers and then drive home. But abused it, and now you can't drink and drive.
And the point they made, several people made, was, you know, cats are really destructive to birds in the environment. People turn their cats loose, and the cats go out and kill birds.
Undeniable.
And they would say, why aren't you doing something about that?
Well, and that was going to be my next point, Craig. I would have no problem extending this measure to frogs, to plants and landscape companies. How many landscape companies are planting Brazilian pepper, and that's how that plant has taken over the Everglades? We need to get the invasives out of Lowe's and Home Depot because
well, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, asparagus fern, there are any number of vines and ivy that people can buy at Home Depot and Lowe's. They put it in their yard and it takes over and it crowds out the native plant life. I would extend this to fish. Lionfish are a huge problem in the Gulf and the around
that came
the
from
Keys,
the aquarium trade,
which we're going to talk about. So I agree that this seems to be targeting the reptile industry, and I would have no problem if this were extended to fish, to birds for that matter, to all non-native wildlife. They don't need to be here. The economic costs are astronomical of the damage that these introduced species do, and whatever economic and it's like all subcultures, you know, that reptile collecting sort of wild animal pet trade subculture is a strange one to anyone on the outside looking into it. And I'm sure they will tout what their economic benefit is to the state for the reptile trade, but there's no way you could ever convince me that the economic benefit offsets by 1/100th the damage that these introduced species are able to do once they get out of their enclosures.
One of the interesting things that came out in the testimony was several people said that they were in a business where they actually go out in South Florida and capture the wild iguanas and then turn around and sell them to collectors in other states, which that's just, it blew my mind. And I can't, you know, and of course, no other state has any regulations on iguanas, and you know, and,
because they don't need to, and you know, that's the sort of what is great about Florida is what makes fighting these invasives so tough, whether it's the invasive plants or the reptiles or the frogs or anything else, is everything can live here because it's so warm.
Look at
what happened in Texas a couple of weeks ago with that huge cold snap. That's what prevents invasives from taking over there. They get frozen out every once in a while and they all die. That doesn't happen, particularly in South Florida. And unfortunately, with climate change, South Florida gets further north every year.
True.
Those pythons that are in the Everglades, you know, soon enough, they're going to be creeping and crawling around Orlando and then in the Okefenokee Swamp if you're not careful.
Well, we did have a big cold snap a couple of years ago, and they noticed that the ones that survived it now seem better able to adapt whenever there is another cold snap. And
which
so
is
evolution at work.
Right. Yeah. Darwinism. Right. You know, the strong survive. So the pythons that are more adaptable to the cold are now the ones that are breeding and succeeding and proliferating. And that's even a scarier nightmare scenario. I want to remind you of our sponsorship with HipCamp. They've been kind enough to sponsor the podcast, and we've got some great testimonials here from HipCamp hosts. Now, HipCamp offers members the opportunity to visit properties throughout Florida, but to do that, they need hosts, and that's where you come in. If you've got a property around Florida near a natural piece of land, a natural environment, HipCamp would love to partner with you to share your land. And here's one from Joan, who's a HipCamp host, quote, "As a new farmer, HipCamp has brought in a steady income and helped us develop our land in new and exciting ways. It is great to see so many people from urban areas come and enjoy our forest," unquote. And another one here from Mackenzie, a HipCamp host. "Truth is, HipCamp has allowed me to keep our land the way it is. I didn't have to think about selling this place because the business model supports my long-term plans. The empty promise of a bulk sale would bring cash to my family, but the dream of keeping this natural space protected, respected, and accessible would die." And if you are interested in partnering with HipCamp to open up your land to HipCamp members, give them a look up today at hipcamp.com/land, hipcamp.com/land. They take care of all of the details and all the insurance and the forms and bookings. Make it as easy as possible on you as it can be. Now, today's guest, Craig, is another Pulitzer Prize winner that you've found for us, and his name is Jack Davis. The book is The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea, Pulitzer Prize from 2017 for nonfiction. Now, Jack lives, grew up on the Gulf. Is that right, Craig?
He grew up in the Gulf. He grew up in the Panhandle, as I did, but has gone on to a very distinguished career as a historian. He is a professor at the University of Florida. He wrote a magnificent biography of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. He was co-editor of a very recent book, The Wilder Heart of Florida, that contains a number of essays about Florida and Florida's wilderness and Florida wildlife. But the book he'll always be remembered for is the one we're going to talk about today, which is a history of the Gulf of Mexico. And as you mentioned, he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for it. It's a magnificent book. I started it with little low expectations because I thought, you know, I've lived on the Gulf all my life. I know everything there is to know about it. And I learned stuff I did not know. And I was totally caught up in the writing of it, too. It's a lyrical book as well as a well-researched one. And if people who haven't read it, I strongly recommend you go get a copy right now because it's just it was a thrilling read. It really was from start to finish.
We will, of course, put a link to where you can find the book down in the show notes, as well as some other episodes from the back catalog that tie into what we're going to talk about, an episode on tarpon fishing, an episode on the Floridan aquifer. And remember, we are sponsored by HipCamp. Got a place to share? Get started today, hipcamp.com/land. And if you'd like to join HipCamp in sponsoring the Welcome to Florida podcast, send us an email at welcometofloridapodcast@gmail.com. That's welcome to, spell out T-O, floridapodcast@gmail.com. And without further ado, let's welcome in Jack Davis.
Jack, tell us how you got interested in writing a whole book on the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, it just doesn't seem like an obvious topic. And yet, once you did it, it's like, oh my God, we needed a book like this.
You said it. I recognize the need there that nobody had written a comprehensive history of the Gulf of Mexico. Simon Winchester wrote about the Atlantic, and he was busy working on the Pacific. And of course, there have been numerous books written about the Mediterranean and other seas as well. And it just seemed logical that the Gulf should have its story told. As you know, I grew up on the Gulf of Mexico, so I have this lifelong intimate relationship with the sea. It's a sea that, as you, I very much love. But also being a historian, I saw that the Gulf of Mexico is not really included in the larger American historical narrative. You can look at high school and college history, U.S. history texts, and in some cases, the Gulf isn't even mentioned. And if it is, it's only mentioned in passing. So I wanted to bring the Gulf into the Gulf story, into that larger historical narrative.
What's your first memory of the Gulf as someone who grew up here?
Obviously, the beach, and I want to say sand crabs. For some reason that comes to mind, you know, because as a little kid, you're fascinated by these little critters scurrying along the beach. As far as something that's really truly animated and that would capture a kid's attention, I suspect it was the sand crabs. As you know, I recently wrote a personal story in my more recent book, co-edited with Leslie Poole, The Wilder Heart of Florida, about my experiences as a kid on Santa Rosa Sound up on the Florida Panhandle. A seine net, a little seine net I brought at a hardware store, really brought my attention to the estuarine environment of the Gulf of Mexico. And as I was writing the Gulf of Mexico book, my mind was constantly casting back to those days as a little kid, pulling that seine net with my sister on one side and me on the other side through fishy, yucky seagrass beds, but coming up with a bounty.
You start off the book with a sort of an unconventional opening. You start off with Winslow Homer. It works. How did you come up with that as a way to get people into this topic, this very vast topic?
I wanted my readers to know, and of course, I always envision my readers as a non-academic, intellectually curious, popular audience, not just Gulfsiders. I wanted this book to reach people beyond the Gulf region. And I also wanted the book to appeal to New York trade press. Of course, New Yorkers are very New York-centric. They seem to know Europe better than they do the American South. So when you're selling a book in New York or to New York press, you've got to show that this is something larger. It's not regional. I didn't want to reject it as regional. Throughout the book, I make these both ecological and historical connections between the Gulf of Mexico and other parts of the country, particularly the Northeast. And, you know, that was strategic, but also makes total sense historically. I decided I wanted to open up with somebody who was not a Gulfsider. You know, I could open up the book with Walter Anderson from Mississippi, for instance. And I considered that and said, no, if one of my points is that the Gulf is not this regional sea, but an American sea, I've got to establish a connection with a faraway place or a person from a faraway place at the outset. And Winslow Homer made sense because he was from Maine, and he was discovering in the little vignette that I opened the book up with, he's discovering the Gulf of Mexico for the first time. He'd been down to southern waters for many years fishing and painting. When he discovered the Gulf of Mexico late in his life, he never went anywhere else in the wintertime. Or I should say he always returned to the Gulf of Mexico until the end of his life.
When you were trying to pitch that book to New Yorkers, how did you sell it briefly as an American sea, as a story that is no less important to the founding of this country than the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean?
First of all, I had to sell it to a literary agent. Mm-hmm. And played with some 25, 26 literary agents. with my book proposal, trying to make this argument that this is not a book about a regional sea, and there's something strategic in that subtitle that you just articulated, Chad, you know, the making of an American sea. Of those 20-some-odd agents I created with, only one responded. Another one, as a favor to a good friend of mine, who's agent for a good friend, agreed to talk to me, and she rejected the book right off the bat. And she said, "Why can't people go to Wikipedia?"
Gulf of Mexico. Wait, after you won the Pulitzer, did you call the other one up and go, nyan.
No, I didn't say anything like that. Not that I haven't thought about that.
How long did you spend researching the book?
It began in fits and starts. After I finished the biography of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, which came out in 2009, I was exploring for a new topic and started the Gulf because I wanted to do another biography of a place. And when the Gulf came to mind, probably in 2010, maybe late 2009, I started exploring the idea of writing it, but then became intimidated by it for reasons that you suggested earlier, Craig, that, you know, it's just, how do you organize a book on history of a sea around this large body of water? I wasn't quite sure how to do it. So I stepped away and explored other possibilities. And then somebody asked me to write an article on actually the Florida Humanities Council for the magazine Forum on the Gulf of Mexico, and that figure out how to organize this history. And that's really the literary genesis of the book is that article. That's when the research began in earnest, was in 2010. I finished writing in 2016. So I'm researching, you know, I did some preliminary research, made a couple trips around the Gulf of Mexico. But as I'm writing, I was still doing my research, quite a bit of research.
How often did you check Wikipedia? I'm just kidding.
as I tell my students, Wikipedia is not a bad place to start. You do not, it's not a trustworthy source.
No.
But what it can bring you, some of those articles, is it can provide you with some from other, to, others, lead you to other sources.
That's true. Was there anything that surprised you in your research, the things that you didn't know?
There was so much I didn't know. I think what surprised me most is how rich the history is and how much my thesis that this is not a regional sea but an American sea was proving itself. The other surprises were some of the, what I call characters, the human subjects in the book. I organized the book around natural characteristics of the Gulf of Mexico, but it, you know, it's the story of the human relationship with the sea, not just simply how humans shape the sea or have impacted the environment, but also how the natural endowments of the Gulf of Mexico have shaped the course of human history. Some of the human subjects or who I call characters, I just found fascinating. So there's some surprises there.
What does the Gulf of Mexico mean to Florida?
It means a lot. I mean, you take away the Gulf of Mexico and think about how different Florida history would be. Think about how different our economy would be. Beach tourism still exceeds Walt Disney tourism, believe it or not. We wouldn't have those beautiful Gulf sunsets. It is extremely important economically in terms of our tourist trade, but also in terms of our commercial fishing industry. The Gulf of Mexico fishing industry for the five U.S. states fishery outperforms the entire east coast of the United States.
Wow.
And Florida benefits as much from that as, you know, places like Louisiana and Texas, in which the commercial fishing industry is extremely important. The birding industry in Florida, the Gulf of Mexico is the most popular saltwater fishing hole in the United States. Extremely important economic industry to Florida. You know, I mean, when you think about it, it's very much a part of our cultural identity. Think of all the businesses and the places with the word Gulf in their names. It would be a lot different. US 19 would not have been, you know, the major tourist thoroughfare that it was before I-75, with all those places along the main Gulf this, Gulf that.
Your book obviously focuses on more than Florida. You've got Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama. How are the various relationships between the individual states and the Gulf different? Florida versus Mississippi, Texas versus Alabama, and how they use it, abuse it, consider it, et cetera.
All five of the U.S. states equally abuse the Gulf of Mexico. It's estuarine environments, but they're also equally dependent upon those estuarine environments. And it's not just the Gulf side states that are abusing those estuarine environments. It's those places far away. Over 60% of the continental U.S. is within the Gulf of Mexico watershed and parts of Canada. So anything you put in the ground up in Iowa, say, ends up in the Gulf of Mexico coming down the Mississippi River. But in terms of protection, a farsightedness about the ecological health of the Gulf of Mexico, there's not a significant amount of difference between the states. Alabama, unfortunately, is probably the least farsighted, in part because it is so xenophobic when it comes to, at least the political structure is, when it comes to, you know, any sort of federal partnership, which would be described as intervention. For instance, Alabama is not a member of the Gulf Islands National Seashore because it didn't want that federal relationship. They didn't want federal interference, which is not to say that Alabama doesn't care about its estuarine environment, but also the watershed that leads to the Gulf of Mexico. To give you one example, Chad, back during World War I, fishermen, commercial fishermen in the Gulf of Mexico wanted to eradicate the brown pelican because of the food shortage within the United States during the war. There was a high price on fish. You know, people were making a lot of money with fish, and fish were plentiful, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico. But commercial fishermen maintained that the brown pelican was a thief, a fish pirate, and was competing with them and hurting their bottom line.
Wow.
So commercial fishermen asked every one of the five states to give them permission to shoot pelicans, get rid of them. And not a single one of those states would allow them to do that. So I think the five states are pretty much on the same page. There are obviously exceptions, particularly when it comes to the oil industry in Louisiana and Texas. But when you talk about the people of the state, and I've given over 120 talks on the Gulf of Mexico, most of those around the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf region, I think the love for the Gulf of Mexico is the same everywhere you go. People just cherish this sea and appreciate it so much.
You mentioned about the oil and gas industry. Obviously, things are very different in the Western Gulf than in the Central and Eastern Gulf when it comes to that. How different would things be for Florida if we did allow drilling in the Eastern Gulf?
It'd be horrific, Craig. You know as well as I know that it's like clockwork. About every 10 years, somebody comes along and starts pushing for offshore oil drilling in Florida. Unfortunately, it never takes. And of course, their argument is, well, we'll put the oil rigs, we'll put the platforms far enough out offshore so the tourists won't see them. That's the problem. The problem is the inshore infrastructure. That's where the real destruction is. Drive along the Louisiana coast, which is a beautiful coastline. Drive along the Texas coast, also a beautiful coastline. It is so fouled by the petrochemical infrastructure. I mean, you know, the pipelines have to go somewhere where they come inshore, to the refineries, to the distribution center. And that's where most of the petrochemical spills come from, is from those inshore structures, fouling the bays and the bayous and the rivers.
Yeah.
So much offshore. And they are extremely unsightly. And if you've ever traveled around the Louisiana coast, you also realize that the petrochemical industry treats the land, the dry land, like a dumping ground for their detritus. I was once in New Orleans, about to drive down to Venice, Louisiana, which is on the coast and one of the busiest commercial fishing villages in the country, setting up my GPS and trying to think of a landmark in Venice, which I couldn't think of, and asked my friend. He said, how about typing in Cheney's company, Dick Cheney's company that was in
Halliburton.
Halliburton. He said, type in Halliburton Road, and just as a joke. I typed in Halliburton Road, and it came up. And you know what? The GPS led us. It led us to a big, giant oil sand landfill, this big, giant pyramid of, you know, you cannot dump your oily sand from an oil rig back out into the Gulf of Mexico. You have to bring it back in, and they turn these things into landfills. So we pull up beside this big black mountain of oily Gulf bottom sediment. We would have those sort of things around. They would replace the the shallow mounds.
I drove from Baton Rouge to Houston one time, and there are sections that seem like they're straight out of the future-looking scenes from the Terminator movies, where there's no sun and it's all soot and smokestacks and pavement and as bleak. And if you want to look in the dictionary for dystopian, that's a dystopian landscape. Some of that stuff around Houston is almost unimaginable. And when you talk about environmental justice, obviously we're going to talk about the environment and Deepwater Horizon and pelicans and fisheries and oysters and all that stuff, the human side of it. Louisiana, of course, has Cancer Alley. That is related a lot to the petrochemical industry and plastics, but they don't put those factories and infrastructures in the nice neighborhoods. And God help the people who have to live anywhere near those places, because even to drive past them sends a chill down my spine.
I couldn't agree with you more, Chad.
One of the things we learned from the Deepwater Horizon disaster, well, two things. One is, it doesn't matter how far away you put the rigs, the oil will wind up on the beach somehow. But the other thing was how little we know about what lives in the Gulf. I mean, over and over, I heard scientists say, we don't know what effect this oil is going to have because we don't know what's out there. We don't know what lives there. Has that changed? Has that improved, do you think? I noticed they just discovered a new whale species living in the Gulf a few weeks ago.
It's changed significantly, and that's one of the, perhaps the only good thing that has come out of the oil spill, is that scientists told me that it was very hard to get funding to do research in the Gulf of Mexico before the oil spill. And now there is tons of money, and there has been, and it continues. And so scientists are learning so much more about the Gulf of Mexico than what they knew before, including discovering new species, as you said, just better understanding the existing life forms, but the ecology of the Gulf of Mexico. But it's also led us into, much of this is coming from BP money, led us into this new era of protecting awareness and protecting the estuarine environments that are so important to the Gulf of Mexico and to our economy and to human life, just, you know, birds and fish.
Deepwater Horizon was 2010, right as you were beginning to research this book. How improved are environmental protections of the estuaries and the waters and the people who fish and live around them now, 10 years, 11 years later, than when they were in the months and weeks leading up to Deepwater Horizon?
That's a really good question. It's a tough one to answer for a couple of reasons. One is that around the Gulf of Mexico, there's much greater awareness. There's much more money going into protection and preservation. Virtually every bay and sound and bayou has one or two environmental groups working on its behalf. But the challenge, there are a couple of challenges that we're facing. One is what's going on upstream, up the watershed, and that we cannot control down on the Gulf of Mexico. There's been no improvement in the quality of the water in the Mississippi River that is responsible for our gigantic Gulf of Mexico dead zone every summer. That dead zone is getting larger, in part because of global warming. And that's the other challenge is, you know, these global changes, sea level rise, global warming, the storms are more intense. The sea is definitely rising. It's having an impact on our shorelines and our estuarine environments. But the response to that has been, at least locally, that all around the Gulf of Mexico, state, local authorities, state authorities, scientists, volunteer organizations, and private landowners are very keen on restoring the living shoreline. This is our best protection against these threats of the 21st century, living shoreline being seagrass beds, mangroves in the southern areas where mangroves will grow, oyster bars. And so there's a great effort off-wide to restore those environments. They're buffers against intense weather. And what people don't always realize is that they are great carbon sinks, you know, pulling CO2 out of the air and out of the water. Those environments are better carbon sinks than a forest, than a healthy forest. That's one thing we don't always acknowledge. When we think about carbon sequestration, we think of forests, but we really should also be thinking of the sea, those estuarine environments. It's mixed. But we also are living, you know, the millennials have come of age, and I think they have a much greater awareness of the needs of the natural environment and the human connection to the natural environment. And they've recognized that the baby boomers like myself have left them this lousy legacy, and they want nothing to do with that legacy. They want to turn that legacy back on itself. So they're real leaders today around the Gulf of Mexico in its protection and restoration.
You talk about the upstream impacts on the Gulf, and I once heard this highly unflattering analogy, but it makes a lot of sense. The Gulf of Mexico is America's toilet. Everything that is flushed out of the Midwest through the Mississippi River, the Ohio River, the Missouri River, any, you know, agricultural runoff pollution from Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Indiana, Wisconsin, Minnesota, like you said, Iowa, all that agricultural runoff, agricultural waste, pig manure, cow manure, that all comes down the Mississippi River and spurts out into the Gulf of Mexico. And it's a fouled place, unfortunately, like you talked about. One thing I'd like you to explain a little bit more to people, because I think it's not understood well enough, I guess. You talk about that living shoreline and how those oyster beds and salt marsh and the dune systems are the best protection against sea level rise, storms. How is that a better system than the concrete breakers and the jetties and the seawalls and the gray infrastructure?
That's a great question, Chad, and I appreciate you asking it. So the gray infrastructure actually contributes to erosion in most cases. The gray infrastructure, whether it's a jetty, whether it's a seawall, redirects natural currents, the natural flow of the water. And it may or may not protect one area, but in doing so, it tends to harm another area. That's what a jetty does. A jetty may keep your channel open, or it may reduce the need of the Army Corps of Engineers coming in with their big dredges, every few years. But some other place along the Gulf of Mexico or along the shoreline is being harmed. Those are not living environments either. Those are not estuarine environments, and they are not carbon sinks. Concrete will discharge carbon for up to 1,000 years. It does not absorb, and it's not producing sea life. So I think it's very much the wrong thing to do. Even though engineers and a lot of scientists too, they want to manage the environment rather than follow the environment as a guide, follow nature's way, which is always the best way in every case. If it's not, then we're living in a place where we should not be living. I want to say a word about red, quote unquote, red tide here. Everybody talks about the red tide down in Southwest Florida, you know, the devastation that it caused a few summers ago. And people are always asking me, well, what about the red tide? What about the red tide? And my response is, don't call it red tide. You need to call it cow tide, because that's what's causing the central issue down in Southwest Florida and Southeast Florida as well on the Atlantic side, is the cow manure and all the pesticides and herbicides that's coming out of the Lake Okeechobee down what used to be rivers, but are now canals, the St. Lucie and the Caloosahatchee, down to the bays and those estuarine environments and washing around to the Gulf side. You call it red tide, which is a natural phenomenon. You blame nature and you let humans off the hook. And politicians in this state have done that. It's wrong.
That flushing from the Midwest is also the source of the infamous dead zone.
Oh, yeah, yeah, as I was saying earlier, yeah. It's just getting worse because nothing, and I write about this extensively in the book, you know, about the subsidies, the federal subsidies for growing corn. You see it historically, you see a trend in which with the expansion of corn growing in the Midwest, the growth and the size of the Gulf of Mexico dead zone. it's not any sort of advantage to the larger economy to grow corn. After all, is a complete failure of a fuel supplement, and we shouldn't be subsidizing the destruction of the Gulf of Mexico. And that dead zone is literally a dead zone. Nothing can live in it. It reaches the size of the state of Delaware in most summers, and some summers the size of the state of Connecticut. That's a lot of death.
One of the things I really appreciated about your book, maybe is the right way to say it, is this sort of double view of the Gulf for people who live there, that on the one hand, it's this source of bounty. It's the source of their economy. It provides them with a living. But on the other hand, it's a risk. Living so close to the Gulf, you're constantly facing hurricanes. You've got problems with storm surge. You got all these other sort of threats coming from the Gulf. And just that duality of it, I thought, was a really good point that you made.
It really wasn't until the late 19th, early 20th century did Americans see living on the shore, on the beach, near the coast as ideal. These were storm-ridden places, and there were issues there. The prevailing belief was, let's just leave it to the working people who have to, you know, the stevedores and the commercial fishing people, and they can live in harm's way. Beach going was not a popular pastime activity in the U.S. until the late 19th century. When we live on the shore, as I suggested earlier, we put ourselves in harm's way. And we've done that time and time again with great haste, I should say, since World War II. And FEMA doesn't help in that regard. It allows us to rebuild in harm's way. There are some real flaws in FEMA policy. The insurance companies have long said, wait a minute, you know, this is a risky place. We're not going to write homeowners policies for people living on the shore any longer. Well, those of us who have lived in Florida and lived in places like Pinellas County are very familiar with losing your homeowners insurance. Federal policy needs to, I think, come of age.
This is going to sound flippant, but it's not. Do you think the rest of America would embrace the Gulf of Mexico more if it wasn't called the Gulf of Mexico? If we changed the name to the Gulf of America, would that get people's attention more?
That's a good question, and I've never really considered. Perhaps
we feel more ownership.
I think perhaps it would. Geographically, it would. I mean, you know, Americans are so, I don't want to insult Americans, but Americans are generally geographically challenged, right?
Well, that's true.
Percentage of people think that New Mexico is actually part of Mexico. And I don't know, if somebody did a survey, they may find that people think the Gulf of Mexico belongs to Mexico.
Make the Gulf of Mexico American again.
There you go. And
you'll have someone wanting to dye it red, Craig.
One thing.
That's where the red tide comes in.
Yeah, well, okay. You're right. And the red tide and the blue sea.
Yeah. Yes.
One thing that people don't realize is that the U.S. occupies half the Gulf of Mexico shoreline. And it shares, and a lot of people don't realize, because I ask my audiences all the time when I give book talks, how many countries are located on the Gulf of Mexico. And I get all these wild numbers. 3, Cuba, Mexico, and the U.S. Almost to the exact mile, half of that shoreline is in U.S. territory or belongs to the 5 U.S. states. That's significant, and we benefit economically more so from the Gulf of Mexico than the other countries. And people are surprised to learn that the Gulf of Mexico is such a rich fishery and an economically important one, both as a recreational place and a commercial place. You may be onto something there to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America.
Yeah. If the previous president didn't think of it and get it done, then that's probably not going to happen, because that sounds like something that would be right up his aisle.
Right.
You obviously spent countless hours on the Gulf of Mexico researching this book, but also living in the area, growing up in the area. What's the most remarkable thing, could be a bad thing, could be a good thing, that you've seen in all of your decades on the Gulf?
The beauty of the natural environment of the Gulf Coast, throughout, all around the Gulf of Mexico, and how it's so varied. The beaches, for instance, are not white all the way around the Gulf of Mexico. We're really fortunate to have these beautiful white beaches. that we have in Florida, because if you ever see a Louisiana beach, it's the same color as a plowed field up in Iowa, because it is. But the, you know, it's, but the Louisiana coast, you know, Chad, when you travel the Louisiana coast, you know, it, yes, there's all this detritus from the petrochemical industry, but it's an inferior place in, as a natural environment. And it's the same with the Texas coast, is, I would very much argue. There are places along there, if you are not moved spiritually, then you better check your pulse. Padre Island, Gulf Islands National Seashore, is one such place. I think very much the variety and the vastness of the natural beauty of the Gulf of Mexico is what really stood out to me most in researching this book.
Yeah, when you travel those areas, you can go from Mad Max to the Garden of Eden in a half hour. And it that is something that gives me hope. You know, the incredible abuses from agriculture, from the fossil fuel industry, from overfishing, you name it, it still exists and it is still resilient, to use an overused word. And if we gave it a break, man, it would come back and reward us in spades, the kind of which we could not even possibly imagine, most of us, if we just gave it a chance to breathe for a second.
Let me give you one quick example of how we've done that as an example for the future. And by the late 1960s, and Craig clearly knows this, virtually every bay and bayou around the Gulf of Mexico was on the verge of death. No place worse than Pensacola, Florida, in its beautiful five bays. But we brought those, I mean, birds disappeared, marine life disappeared, birds disappeared, fishing disappeared. But we brought those bays and bayous back to thriving life thanks to the 1972 Clean Water Act and other initiatives, local and nationally, and also with thanks to the efforts of some good people, volunteers, as well as policymakers and businesses who all pitched in to bring them back to life. Tampa Bay wouldn't be the bay. I mean, when I was a kid on Tampa Bay, you know, the only fish I could catch was a croaker. I got really lucky. I could catch a speckled trout, and I never saw anything other than gulls and pelicans. Now look at the bird life we see and what kind of fish you can catch on Tampa Bay.
This is the most important question I have to ask you, which is, what's your favorite beach bar and what's your favorite seafood restaurant around the Gulf?
You know, we'll put it this way. An oldie but goodie and a trustworthy one is, of course, the Hurricane on St. Pete Beach. You can get a good grouper fish a sandwich there, and you can still see some of the most beautiful sunsets in the world from there. And listen to some good music and take a stroll out on the beach. You, Craig, I live landlocked in Gainesville now, so you've
well, I love the Hurricane, of course. I have to stick up for the Panhandle and say a nice word about the Floribama Lounge and their
correct
interstate mullet toss competition.
right yeah.
Optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the Gulf?
I have to say I'm optimistic because of the love I've seen for the Gulf of Mexico, because I think petrochemical industry is dated. I think as the owner of a Nissan Leaf, I think that electric vehicles are the future. And let me tell you what, oh, what a fantastic automobile and our electric cars. And but also because of the millennials in charge now, as far as I'm concerned, or should be, they care very much about it. And also because, as I mentioned earlier, every important body of water around the Gulf of Mexico has one or two or three groups protecting it and working to preserve its future.
Jack Davis has been our guest. The book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea, Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction in 2017. Thank you for your time today, Jack. It's been an enlightening conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks again, Jack.
I'm delighted, and it was a lot of fun chatting with you guys.
Craig, you started the interview asking Jack what his first memory of the Gulf is. Of course, you have lived most of your life spitting distance from the Gulf, Pensacola, now St. Pete. What's your first memory of the Gulf?
Probably when my aunt and uncle took me out to the beach for the first time, and you know, a little classic black and white photo from that day. I still have it. Me in a little swim diaper and little water wings on my arms, little inflated water wings. And I'm sitting in the water and with this, the biggest smile on my face as the waves are coming in. And I have to admit, I still kind of get that feeling inside every time I'm near the Gulf. I really enjoy going out there to the beach, no matter what time of year. I mean, even if it's cold and windy and the skies are gray, I just love walking on the beach and hearing those waves coming in. And it's very soothing to me emotionally and psychologically and spiritually, just to be that close to the water and to hear that. I mean, that's the soundtrack of my life right there.
Those are the soundtracks and memories and experiences that Hip Camp members are looking for, and Hip Camp is hoping you can connect them to them. Hip Camp is a growing community of respectful people looking to get outside for camping, glamping, RV stays on private land. Think of it as Airbnb for campers. And Hip Camp has all these members in the Midwest, all these members in the Northeast who want to come to Florida, particularly in the winter months, in the spring months, or come down, maybe see a little spring training, but also get outside and kayak and get up and do some stand-up paddle boarding and look for shark's teeth and seashells and that sort of stuff. And they need landowners like yourself with a flat spot where someone can pitch a tent or park an RV to offer to their members and get them connected with this great Florida natural scenery and natural landscape that we get to enjoy every day. So if you've got a place to share, get started today at hipcamp.com/land, hipcamp.com/land.
What was your first experience with the Gulf?
Oh, goodness.
Because you live on the Atlantic side, so it's
I live on the Atlantic side, right. So this would have been either in my childhood visiting Florida. You know what it was? Strangely enough, it ties back to a previous episode, Tarpon Springs and the sponging.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would have been, this is one of my earliest childhood memories. Came down to Florida for a spring break from Wisconsin with my mom and my brother, and we went through Tarpon Springs, and I still have some visual memory, whether this is accurate or not, of the sponges hanging on the lines and right there on the water, on the coast and the shore there. And we bought sponges like all the tourists did and brought them back and stuck them in the shower. And absolutely, I can still see what those sponges looked like. I can still feel what they felt like in my hand. And again, coming from Wisconsin, coming from all that corn and gray and those hardwood trees, and here I am on this beach and people are pulling sponges out of it. Again, this was like going to Mars. It was so exotic and so foreign and so wonderful. It was a different country.
Did you go out on the sponge boat, the suit where they show you the guy in the old diving suit going down?
No, we did more of that. I think bad. At Wiki Wachee, where we did the glass bottom boat and we saw the mermaids and the gar and you know, that old timey, you know, 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea or whatever, that with the big round helmet for the scuba guys connected to the hose.
Well, yeah. if you go to Tarpon, they actually have a sponge boat you can go out on. It's strictly for the tourists. And I have a friend who every time we mention Tarpon Springs, he brings it up and goes, "Watch the diver go down and get the sponge." he does the spiel that they have running on the sponge docks all day. Watch the live sponge. Watch the diver go down and get the sponge.